You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with author Andre Debus III. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I rely on the writing process to bring me back to memory. To remember means to reach for the pieces, to reach for the fragments, to reach for the shards. And I think in many ways, all creative writing is that act of reaching for the pieces, to put it back together again. With the memoir, the essay, it's human memory, right? Your memory for your own existence. With fiction, it's something else. It's a dream world where you're reaching for the shards. And I find it so moving because that's what it feels like when I feel that I might be writing well. It's just uncovering and uncovering. If you want to just check in, you want some clarity on what you believe, I just tell people, well, just write something really honest and emotionally naked and read it back to yourself. And you'll see a lot of what you believe and what you think and what you fear and regret and desire, et cetera. We always reveal ourselves in our work. The truth is, I identify far more with those on the outside than on the inside. Even though from the outside, it looks like I'm on the inside. I'm a successful author, professor, white, privileged, educated, straight male from the United States. You can't get more privileged than that in a patriarchal, misogynistic society, but racist society. But I don't identify with those people. I don't know if it's because of my youth or just how I am in the world. But I don't know. When you read that passage back to me about my hatred of all those things, that hatred for those kinds of injustices have never left me. In fact, they've just grown sharper. And so I teach young people, and I find it immensely gratifying to do so. But especially for those who've already found writing in their blood so young, I said, you know how lucky you are to have found something that makes you feel so alive this early in your life? People live whole lives and never find it. You know, I wrote about this in my memoir, Townie, This Moment. But, you know, I was a small boy. I was bullied. My sister was raped. My brother was beaten up by a grown man. I couldn't defend him. I became a fighter and a crazy young man. I'll compress this, but I was in my late teens and early 20s. I would really rather die a violent death than see a coward in the mirror anymore. That made me a very dangerous man, but also I hated violence. I hated cruelty. I hated injustice. I found myself going after men hitting women and men smaller than they were, etc. But I knew I was going to get killed doing this, or maybe worse than that, I could kill someone else. This boy who hated violence could become a killer. So as a way to control my violence, I started to box. I said, that'll be my sport. And one night, instead of going to the gym to train, and I was training for the Golden Gloves competition, which I was very serious about, something that I can only call the divine made me sit down in a chair and brew a cup of tea. And me, I found myself writing from the point of view of a young woman having sex for the first time with her boyfriend in his car in the misty rain of the Maine woods. I don't know where this came from, but I remember I took a sip of this tea I'd brewed and it had been boiling minutes earlier, but now it was almost cold. I thought I'd been writing for a few minutes, but it was clearly over an hour. And when I put that pencil down, and I'm still in all my workout clothes, it's winter, it's nighttime, I've been working construction all day and I was heading to the gym to train. I read over what I wrote and I had never felt more like myself. I felt like Andre for the first time. I was in my early 20s. And I'm not saying that at that moment I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I knew that in order to keep feeling this authentically like me, I would have to keep writing. I love character actors. I love the actor who isn't the lead. Who's that? I've seen her before. They get lost in that secondary character and they become this other human being. For me, one of the joys of, I've got a novel called The Garden Last Days, and the draft I sent to my publisher had 14 points of view. And I tried to make every single one a distinct voice, a distinct vision, from a 3-year-old girl to a 9/11 hijacker from Saudi Arabia, to a 26-year-old sex worker, on and on. It was such a joy for me to do that, and it still remains a joy. For me, it's got to be like a radical curiosity. My friend Elizabeth Strout, whose work I revere, says, for me, I have to be desperately curious about my characters. You know, I did some acting in my 20s and 30s, and it's an art form I really admire. I think it's very difficult to do well, of course, but it's a sister art form where you are emptying yourself of yourself to become someone else, except you're bringing your humanity to whoever's point of view you're writing from, whether it's a man or a woman, someone from a different race or ethnicity or religious background. We human beings share far more than we do not. And so we have to find that common thread. But you're right. It's ironic that you find more of yourself stepping into the private skin of another. But isn't that always also the case being a reader? You know, we read from the points of view of other human beings, sometimes from cultures we've never even stepped into, and we find more of ourselves than we did before. It's the miraculous promise of literature, I think. Let's talk about ego. It takes a certain amount of ego to think you can even pull this off. And there are long, important works just arguing, well, who tends to believe they have a right to try? We can talk about marginalized voices and racism and sexism. It's all valid discussion. But every writer who goes to their private space has to believe he, she, they have a right to try. It takes ego to get to that space. There are two aspects of that. One, when you're in a receptive state, when you are willing to accept anything that comes, no matter what it is, easier said than done. We don't live our lives that way. So how do you do that? Well, you must let go of what you want to write, number one. You must let go of how you want it to sound. There's a wonderful essay by the American poet William Stafford, where he says, the poet before writing must put herself into a place of openness or receptivity. And he said, you know you're being receptive when you are, and this is really hard, I think, especially for Americans who still eat a steady diet of the following. The point of life is to be happy, and the way to be happy is to be a success. It's horseshit. This is not the point of life. It's a lie. And the second part is you must be willing to fail. Not, oh, I'm going to tolerate a little bit of it. I am going to totally fail at this, but I'm still going to do it anyway. House of Sand and Fog. This woman loses her home and then loses everything. I read a short, all creative writing is that act of reaching for the pieces to put it back together again. With the memoir, the essay, it's human memory, right? Your memory for your own existence. With fiction, it's something else. It's a dream world where you're reaching for the shards. So moving, because that's what it feels like when I feel that I might be writing well, which is once every 18 days or so. It's just uncovering. In the Boston Globe, one of those little short national news briefs about a woman in California who was evicted from her house for failure to pay back taxes. She says she didn't owe. The county evicted her anyway, repossessed her house, auctioned it off, and then discovered, oops, computer error, bureaucratic error, wrong house. But the man who bought it at an auction was under no legal pressure to sell it back, and he wasn't sure he wanted to because he was going to make a killing on the resale. I saw that in the Globe, and I cut it out, and I put it in my little story idea notebook. So back up 15 years. In college, I fell in love with an Iranian girl. I quickly discovered you can't date a Shiite Muslim girl from the upper classes of Iran the way I would date, which is, hey, I stole a six-pack when I go drink it in the parking lot. So I had to date her whole family. I had to sit and go to the apartment where her mother was and her little brother and little sister. And then eventually her father came from Europe. And her father had worked closely with the Shah of Iran. He was a colonel in the Shah's Air Force. I watched this man work 16 hours a day in menial jobs. First 8 hours were at a shoe factory across the river, a place I had worked stamping shoe soles. The other was at a convenience store, gas station behind the register. And on those rare days he got off, he put on his best suit and he'd go look for work as an aeronautical engineer he was. He could never find work. One night I'm in an elevator helping him bring his groceries in. He's had another 16-hour day. He looks exhausted. He looks much older than he was, which is probably only late 50s. I was 19 or 20 years old, Mia. And he said to me in his thick Persian accent, you know, I used to work with kings and queens and presidents and vice presidents and prime ministers of entire countries in my office by myself. Now I'm serving candy and cigarettes to kids who don't even know who I am. And he said, I never thought that would happen to me. And I never forgot it. 15 years later, I reread that article about the woman, and I see that the man in the real news article had a Middle Eastern name. I think he was Arabic and not Persian. Immediately the question was, what if my Iranian colonel bought that house? That's how the novel began. For me, it always begins with a question. Self-educate yourself. Information and knowledge are so different. They're not the same. I am deeply concerned about the digital world. I do not own an iPhone. I've never sent a text. I've never been on social media. It's because I've seen this horrible depletion of joy in my college students over the last 20 years, 15 years. It's not global warming. It's not mass shootings. which are horrific enough. It's staring at those screens 6 to 11 hours a day. It's sucking their life force out of them. So I have real issues with technology, but I love the internet. I love its democratization of information across the globe for those who are fortunate enough to have internet access. My deep concerns about the handheld, I call them crack gadgets, and I will never own one for moral reasons, is that it's casting everybody in a trance. It's taking out of them, it's taking from them the only thing we have, which is the present moment. I don't want to sound self-pitying when I say this, but the truth is I grew up, we moved 2 or 3 times a year. I was always the new kid. My dad lived elsewhere. My relatives lived 2,000 miles away. So I didn't have a lot of adults in my life. And I became this kind of shy, quiet kid who did not ask for help from anybody. I didn't reach out for teachers. I still don't. And so when you say that, the only teacher comes to mind when you say that, when I started to box, his name was Paul Harriman. He taught me how to throw a right cross. And it was the first time in a long time a grown man looked at me, took me in, and gave me about 5 minutes of his time. And just that one act turned my life 3 degrees in a more positive direction. I didn't have a lot of teachers. I didn't have a lot of mentors. I was blessed to have a beautiful writer as a father, but he was more of a buddy. His writing teaches me, but that wasn't there when we were alive together. I think what strikes me so much about education, or being an educator, the word to educate from the Latin means to draw out or to lead. So it shouldn't be about stuffing information or data into, but drawing out. Who are you? I try to draw them out through whatever we're reading, whatever they're writing, whatever we're talking about, to draw them out into themselves. Because life goes by like this. If you're not living an authentic life, you're not going to have a joyful life. If you're not going to have a joyful life, you're not going to give back freely to people around you who need more and don't have your privileges. I don't think anyone has a better imagination than anybody else. That's not to say that some writers don't write more compelling work than others, but it's not because their imagination's better. It has to do with the tools they're using or not, which can be taught. And the fuel for that, back to where we began, has got to be authentic curiosity about the lives of others. In order to be authentically curious, you must suffer with them yourself. Compassion literally means to suffer with. Young people are so receptive to that way of looking at the world. I think it shows them that they count, that they have value, and that they too can do something large by doing something small and humble. And it's beautiful.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.